I'm Paul Kennedy, and this is Ideas. Extinction is forever, right? Well, not necessarily. Today, ideas about de-extinction, the science of bringing back animals that are now extinct.
Yeah, this is like the space race for biology. You know, can we actually recreate an organism that isn't around anymore?
Like woolly mammoths, gastric brooding frogs, passenger pigeons, and a flock of other candidates.
Can we actually do this? We're talking about that we can, but there's still several hurdles to jump over to get to the actual de-extinction event.
Can we? And should we?
We need to be talking about not just, oh, technically we can make it or not, but where's it going to go? What are going to be the challenges? How are people going to understand this?
All it takes is a glass of red wine in the evening to stop and realize, wow, this, you know, we're moving in this direction, but really, what are the implications, the ramifications?
Okay, everybody, settle down, and we'll tell you all about it. Here's Britt Ray with Undoing Forever.
I must have been about 7 years old when I first saw the movie Jurassic Park. I was too little to know anything about Michael Crichton, who wrote the book the movie was based on, or about Steven Spielberg, who directed it. But I was just the right age to think that dinosaurs, coming back to life, was a very cool idea.
It's a dinosaur. Uh-huh.
Now, how they did it, the science, went over my head. It had something to do with something called DNA.
What? Oh, Mr. DNA, where did you come from?
From your blood. Just one drop of your blood contains billions of strands of DNA, the building blocks of life. A DNA strand, like me, is a blueprint for building a living thing. And sometimes animals that went extinct millions of years ago, like dinosaurs, left...
As for the dinosaurs themselves, well, there was this one scene where they were very scary. There were these raptors, wiry, vicious, fast, hungry dinosaurs. And here I was, a kid, watching other kids getting chased by them, in the dark, in a lab. Now, the reason I'm telling you about Jurassic Park is because the minute you talk to anyone about de-extinction, at least from my experience, they always mention that movie. So you need to know that there are no raptors in our story today. No dinosaurs, even. The ones that died out, well, that happened 65 million years ago. So long ago, it's too challenging to work with their DNA. The science here, the real science, is in its earliest stages. And it's not quite like it is in the movies.
It's not as exciting. It's not as sensationalist. We're not bringing an animal that is extinct back to life. That is just not possible.
Beth Shapiro is an evolutionary biologist at the University of California, Santa Cruz.
For the most part, when we talk about de-extinction, people are imagining bringing an identical copy of an extinct animal back to life. And that is very hard to imagine. A situation in which one would really bring something back to life that is completely identical to a species that is gone. What we might be able to do in future is to bring back some traits, some characteristics that used to exist in species that are now extinct, in species that are still alive.
Take the passenger pigeon. It's the poster bird today for de-extinction. For thousands of years, passenger pigeons lived and flew across most of North America, from the East to the Midwest. They moved in massive flocks, billions of them. But by the end of the 19th century, their numbers started to dwindle. On September 1st, 1914, the very last passenger pigeon, a female named Martha, died in the Cincinnati Zoo. Today, the largest collection of them is at the Royal Ontario Museum in Toronto.
I will open up the passenger pigeon cabinet for you.
154 of them are here, stuffed and neatly arranged in metal cabinets. Mark Peck takes care of the museum's ornithology collection.
And what do we have? 1.5 shells of females. So males are easier to identify. They tend to have sort of a buffy orange breast associated with them, whereas the females tend to be more of a gray breast. The back of the bird, you get a nice gray on the males, and the females are a little more cryptically colored. They're approximately the same size, though.
Most of these birds are lying lifeless on their backs, but some of them have been posed to look a little more lively.
This is a small collection. Some of our better-looking birds, some of them have their wings open, some of them are partially closed, some of them are sitting on a branch with their tails fanned. You know, and the wonderful thing about passenger pigeons is they were thought to be one of the most common birds on Earth. They talk about a population of 6 billion birds darkening the skies for 3 days when the big flocks came in to feed on the acorns and the beech mast. So it was a remarkable bird in a lot of ways. And to think that a bird that was so common could go extinct in really 50 years due to habitat loss, due to hunting pressures and market hunting.
What were people hunting them for?
Oh, for food. Especially for some of the bigger cities, you could go into these huge breeding colonies, you could smoke them out, or, you know, in a single shotgun, you could shoot as many as 20 or 25 birds with a single shot. They'd be quickly feathers removed and stuffed into barrels and salted. The young especially had a lot of fat associated with them when they first leave the nest, the squabs. So they'd be used in some of the finer restaurants in New York and Chicago and Toronto. They talk about trains carrying nothing but passenger pigeons down to some of the bigger cities in barrels.
So that was the end of the passenger pigeon, until a few years ago, when a plan was hatched to bring the bird back to life. Stuart Brand was at the center of it all. He's a conservation biologist, writer, and a longtime champion of sustainable living.
You know, in the past, all you could do with extinction is just grieve. And it's still the case. I think most extinctions will stick. The animal's gone, it's gone. But in some cases, for a variety of reasons that we're still learning what criteria are for doing the incredible work to try to bring an animal back. And if the technology is at the point where that particular kind of species can be brought back, then you want to bear down and make it happen.
But how do we make a past that is gone? For Stuart Brand, it all started when his wife, Ryan Phelan, got involved.
Through my wife, who's been doing businesses in genetic technology, I got acquainted with this guy, George Church, at Harvard, who also was interested in passenger pigeons.
George Church is a professor of genetics at Harvard Medical School and a world-renowned inventor of genetic technologies.
It mainly has techniques that look like you might be able to take DNA from extinct animals and basically swap it into the genomes of living animals and turn the living animal into the extinct animal and get them back. And once I got wind of that, I thought, this has got to be pursued, so I pursued it.
May 24th, 2011. From an email by Stuart Brand to George Church and to the great evolutionary biologist, E.O. Wilson.
Dear Ed and George, the death of the last passenger pigeon in 1914 was an event that broke the public's heart and persuaded everyone that extinction is the core of humanity's relation with nature. George, could we bring the bird back through genetic techniques? The environmental and conservation movements have mired themselves in a tragic view of life. The return of the passenger pigeon could shake them out of it and invite them to embrace prudent biotechnology as a green tool, instead of menace in this century. I would gladly set up a nonprofit to fund the passenger pigeon revival. Wild scheme. Could be fun. Could improve things. It could, as they say, advance the story.
And the story did advance. Stuart Brand and Ryan Phelan set up an organization called Revive and Restore.
We're looking at bringing extinct species back to life. Specifically, we're focusing on the passenger pigeon, but it turns out there's a lot of people doing various aspects of de-extinction all over the world, and so we've been helping bring those people together.
Among them, Ben Novak. He's a zealous 20-something-year-old biologist with a real passion for passenger pigeons.
So I was in junior high when I first discovered in a book what a passenger pigeon was, and I fell in love with this beautiful photograph of this very elegant and regal bird. And that kind of just really gripped me that, you know, one, there's this sadness that I would never get to see it, and two, I don't even know if I can even imagine what a flock of a billion birds might be like. I mean, there's really nothing that comes close to it today.
Eventually, Revive and Restore hired Ben Novak as the lead scientist on The Great Comeback, their passenger pigeon project.
What was my childhood dream was starting to form into a real career path. The biggest dream, of course, is not only to have passenger pigeons back into the wild doing what passenger pigeons do, but that what we learn out of this project and what we develop out of this project is going to be applicable to all types of species.
But to take a stab at this, Novak needed to work in a lab with the equipment and the expertise to get the job done. So Revive and Restore hooked him up with Beth Shapiro, the evolutionary biologist. She'd been researching extinct birds for years and had her own questions about the rise and fall of the passenger pigeon.
The passenger pigeon is a fascinating animal. It is tremendously weird how exactly the bird became that abundant and why it was able to go from being that abundant to extinction over the course of several decades is a mystery, and a mystery worth solving.
A mystery that is at the genetics level. Sure, they were overhunted for food, but why didn't at least some of these birds, when there were billions of them, manage to adapt, evolve, and survive? Shapiro hopes to solve this mystery by looking for clues in the bird's genome, its genetic blueprint, and that's her focus here.
I am personally not at all interested in bringing the passenger pigeon back to life. We're a genomics lab. We are interested in understanding genomes and evolution, but that's as far as my research with this particular project is going to go.
So Shapiro and Novak got down to work. First up, the passenger pigeon genome. But for that, you need passenger pigeon DNA. Now, DNA is often referred to as the building blocks of life. But it's really just a bunch of molecules strung together. And the way they're arranged into genes codes for certain traits, like eye color or body shape. And if you're a passenger pigeon, then all the crucial things that make you a passenger pigeon, and not any other kind of bird. So genomes are made of genes that are made of DNA. And DNA, well, in the case of passenger pigeons, it's inside the ones that are still around today. Dead birds. It's Ben Novak's job to get it out.
So I do the DNA extractions, I handle the specimens. For the passenger pigeon study, we've actually been using a large sample set from the Royal Ontario Museum in Toronto. And they've been quite well taken care of. So we have a nice large set of tissue from passenger pigeons there. It's just a little tiny piece of the toe that's cut off, about the size of a pinhead. And in the lab, I'll cut that in half and dissolve it up in enzymes, destroy the proteins, filter out the DNA, and I'll start working with the DNA from there to get it to a level where it can be sequenced.
Now, we are currently piecing together the genome sequence of the passenger pigeon. It is ancient DNA, which means the DNA fragments themselves are in terrible condition. They're fragmented into very short pieces. Those pieces contain lots of chemical damages that make it very hard to piece that genome together.
The DNA is randomly fragmented from deterioration with age, and so you don't have that ability. It's like if you were to take the puzzle and round off the edges of the pieces. We are getting our first glimpses of, you know, good chunks of passenger pigeon DNA put back in the right order, but it's a tedious process to go from that piece of tissue to putting DNA back together.
How do you know when it's in the right order if you don't have the original sequence to compare it to?
Well, that comes down to using a close relatives sequence. So for us, that's the band-tailed pigeon genome.
The band-tailed pigeon is very much alive today, flying across the Americas, from British Columbia down to Mexico. So the idea here is to use the band-tailed pigeon genome as a template, or pattern, to help them assemble the passenger pigeon genome. But that template doesn't come out of thin air.
So we're putting together the genome of the band-tailed pigeon. No one had done that before. Now, for a living animal, you don't need that extra genome to put something together because the DNA is in this nice state of, I don't want to call it freshness, but the DNA is intact enough to put the passenger pigeon genome back together from these tiny chunks of DNA.
The next step is to compare these two genomes and to look for places in those genomes where the birds are different from each other.
There will be long spans of the genome in which the DNA is nearly identical, and then there will be these regions where the DNA is what we call highly diverged, meaning that through the evolution of these two animals, some region in the genome has accumulated mutations in each bird that makes one purple and one blue, that makes one have a brick-shaped tail and the other have a dove-shaped tail.
There will be many places in the genomes where the birds differ, many millions of places even, where they're different from each other. So a next step would be to identify which of those differences are really critical to making a passenger pigeon look and act like a passenger pigeon instead of like a band-tailed pigeon.
You might have noticed that with all this talk about putting together genomes, there's still no passenger pigeon here. So how do you get from here to there? Beth Shapiro.
This is something that we are in the very early stages of knowing what to do. Most likely this would happen using genome editing technologies, an enzyme system known as CRISPRs.
CRISPRs are tiny genetic scissors made out of proteins called enzymes. They cause biochemical changes.
The CRISPRs can actually target the place in the genome where you want to make a change, and the CRISPRs go and find that place in the genome and cut it at exactly the right place in such a way that you can actually edit the DNA sequence itself.
Edit, in gene speak, means snipping out the DNA you want from the passenger pigeon genome, then snipping out the related DNA from the band-tailed pigeon, and replacing it with your passenger pigeon DNA.
So this is the type of technology that would be used, potentially, to edit a band-tailed pigeon genome to look more like a passenger pigeon genome. This research is really in its very early stages, and if one might imagine needing to make many millions of edits, I think we're not there yet. We're not even close to there yet. And then, of course, one would have to take that edited genome and somehow turn that into a bird. And this is also a very complicated process scientifically that we don't quite have the technology to accomplish yet.
But that hasn't stopped Ben Novak from planning what's next. First, hijack an embryo that's growing inside a pregnant band-tailed pigeon. Then, take the genetic material you engineered in the lab and inject it into the embryo. If this works, then somehow DNA from the passenger pigeon will end up in the embryo's reproductive cells.
Now, when this bird hatches, we're going to get something called a chimera. It's not a passenger pigeon. It is a band-tailed pigeon. Looks like a band-tailed pigeon, but they carry the passenger pigeon genetic code. So if you create a male chimera and a female chimera, and then, you know, let them fall in love and have some babies, their babies will be the passenger pigeons that we've genetically created.
Sounds pretty straightforward, but it's not. Beth Shapiro.
Equally importantly, one would have to figure out how to make that bird, when it was born, look and act like a passenger pigeon instead of like a band-tailed pigeon.
But how on earth do you do that?
That is an excellent question, and we do not know the answer. I don't know what the behavioral differences that distinguish a passenger pigeon from a band-tailed pigeon are, and this is something that would be important to understand when trying to select which genes to actually change, or what kind of environment one would need to establish in captivity in order to raise the next generation of slightly manipulated band-tailed pigeons. So there is more to making a species look and act like that particular species than just its genome sequence.
Passenger pigeons are not the only extinct species that people would like to revive. Woolly mammoths are another popular candidate. They were like big, hairy elephants, and for thousands of years, they roamed all over the world. Most of the woolies went extinct about 11,000 years ago. The rest hung on, but eventually died out too, about 3,500 years ago. Hendrik Poinar is an evolutionary geneticist at McMaster University. He's a leading expert on mammoths and ancient DNA, but there's something else you should know about him. He's also the son of George Poinar Jr., a scientist who studied ancient DNA and inspired Michael Crichton to write Jurassic Park. So it's not surprising, when his dad is who he is, that Hendrik Poinar has a love for extinct beasts.
I guess that the love for mammoths goes back to my youth, really. Growing up as a kid, the mammoth was a particular animal that I was fond of. I know my dad had a particular fondness for dinosaurs, which I had absolutely very little interest in. I was much more interested in the Pleistocene beasts because they seemed much closer in terms of time. And of course, I spent several summers in France, and if you have the rare opportunity to go to the caves, and you can actually see that humans, our ancestors, were painting images of mammoths and bison and horses on the landscape at the time, I felt somehow that this collective memory was still within my genes, so to speak.
From his genes to mammoth genes. And he's not just working with woolies. He's assembling all kinds of mammoth genomes from these proboscideans, or early relatives of the elephant, like the Columbian and Trongontheri. As for bringing mammoths back, well, here's how he sees his work fitting in.
The way most people, you know, in the de-extinction field see it playing in is that if we can provide sort of a high-quality genome of these extinct proboscideans, so the Columbian, the woolly, maybe the Trongontheri, which was a European and North American mammoth that's a little bit older. If we can do that, then they're using CRISPR technology. We might be able to take an Asian elephant, change it to be woolly or Columbian-like, in the hopes that then you could revive these extinct beasts.
Work along these lines has already started in George Church's lab at Harvard University. So far, they've identified dozens of genes from the cells of Asian elephants that can be changed into genes from woolly mammoths. They're now seeing what effect that has. And Church has said that by 2019, he expects to produce a mammoth elephant embryo. That's Asian elephant with genetic ingredients from the woolly mammoth. But it will take much longer than that to actually grow those engineered embryos inside surrogate mothers or artificial wombs, a technology his lab is also developing. Or until these creatures can be de-extincted without any problems or defects. So, when can we expect to see hairy elephants strolling around?
I would say something like a woolly mammoth would be something like 30 to 40. 50 years at the earliest would be my guess.
That's a long time away. But there are other ways of doing de-extinction that seem to be moving much faster. One being cloning. This is the same technique that was used to clone Dolly the sheep. But there's a crucial difference here. Dolly was a copy of a living animal. But with de-extinction, you're trying to clone an animal that's already dead. Take the case of the Bucardo, also known as the Pyrenean ibex. It was a wild mountain goat that lived in the Spanish Pyrenees Mountains until the year 2000. That year, the very last one, a 13-year-old named Celia was crushed to death by a branch that fell from a tree. Now, before Celia died, a Spanish scientist named Alberto Fernandez Arias had taken some cells from her ear and frozen them in liquid nitrogen. That kind of freezing is called cryopreservation, and these cells were whole and intact, exactly what you need for cloning. So after Celia died, Fernandez Arias and his team took DNA from one of her frozen cells and implanted it into the egg of a surrogate goat mother. They did this 57 times. Then finally, one of them took. On July 30th, 2003, Celia's clone was born, then died. Ben Novak.
The Bucardo was revived for, you know, a period of about 7 minutes. So, you know, it may be in the next 2 to 3 years or 5 years that we actually have a healthy, beautiful baby Bucardo running about. There's also the gastric brooding frog project going on.
They went extinct in Australia in the 1980s. A team at the University of New South Wales is trying to clone them now.
And they do have embryos developing, but they have some challenges to get those embryos fully developed into adults. And that could see some major successes soon. The major hiccup for them is they can only collect eggs to work with once a year, the season in which the frogs they use are breeding, the living frogs. And so, you know, they do a test once a year and try to work. And if it doesn't work, then they've got to wait for a little while. But those are all projects using cryopreserved cells from very recently extinct species. And so they get to use cloning and their DNA is all intact. And, you know, when we're considering a passenger pigeon or a mammoth, we're thinking about tiny chunks of DNA that all we can get is the code from them. And then we have to do all this genetic engineering.
But not all de-extinction projects need to happen in a lab. You can also use backbreeding, a technique that humans have been using for years. It's also known as artificial selection. You just keep breeding animals with the traits you're looking for until you have offspring that look and behave the way you want them to. In the Netherlands today, they're backbreeding cattle until they remind them of the auroch, an austere-looking cow that went extinct in the 1600s. Stuart Brand.
So they're backbreeding domestic cattle, all of which are descendants of the European aurochs that used to cover the whole continent from the Atlantic to the Pacific. They're just going for, does it look and act like an aurochs? Is it hardy? Can it go wild on its own? Can it take care of the winter? Can it find food on its own? Is it great big guy, 6 feet at the shoulder for the bull, smaller for the cow? Is it dark with a light-colored stripe down its back the way the old aurochs used to have? And if it quacks like a duck and walks like a duck and flies like a duck, as far as they're concerned, it's a duck.
You're listening to Ideas in Canada on CBC Radio 1, across North America on Sirius XM, and around the world on cbc.ca. I'm Paul Kennedy. Today, ideas about de-extinction, the science of bringing back animals that are now extinct. Undoing Forever is presented by Britt Ray and... Is that a mammoth I hear before me? Britt, help me out here.
It's just what we think mammoths sounded like, Paul, but they're actually elephants. Unless an animal went extinct relatively recently, we don't know exactly what it sounded like. And mammoths, they haven't been around for ages.
Thank you, Britt. It's been very helpful, but I think it's probably a good idea for me to step aside and you can carry on.
So far, we've been looking at the actual hands-on science of de-extinction. But there's a question that's been simmering away here all along. Should we even be doing this? Is de-extinction, for example, just humans playing God? Ben Novak.
This isn't playing God. You know, we are working from a blueprint of nature. We're not trying to create some new form of life. If, in the belief that God created life, we are actually trying to bring back something of his that we destroyed, which I think would be, in an almost religious sense, the right thing to do. But on another level, we're not trying to defy the laws of nature in any way. We're trying to study the proceedings of nature and work with them to have a healthier world for our future. And that's not superior. That's just being responsible.
But how responsible is it to engineer nature that can't exist without human intervention? Stuart Brand.
I think the artificiality or engineering aspect of this, each time it comes along, people say, wait a minute. So when in vitro fertilization came along, a lot of people said, well, the only place that eggs and sperm are supposed to get together is in the familiar old place, and we don't want it happening in a petri dish because there's going to be something wrong with the babies, and then maybe there's something wrong with the parents for even wanting to do it. And there was a lot of suspicion and worry about it. But when it came along, it was high-tech engineering solution to infertility in some families. People saw the healthy baby and the ecstatic parents, and the kid grew up into somebody great, and they stopped worrying and went from, how dare they do that, to how can I get some? The other thing that is kind of interesting is people get worried that, well, if you bring back a pasture pigeon, it might not be the genetic duplicate of the one that went away.
And that's because it's a passenger pigeon and band-tailed pigeon mix.
And the reality of genetic mix is a familiar one to biologists who've worked in these fields. And so they're not pushed out of shape about, well, it might not be a perfect passenger pigeon. All they're looking for, in most cases, is ecological function.
Ecological function is a term you hear all the time from people who are working on de-extinction. It refers to the role an animal plays in its environment, ecologically speaking. Mammoths, for example, were like giant ventilating systems. They lumbered around with their big mammoth feet and punched holes in the snow. This made it easier for cold air to circulate and the climate up north to stay frigid. Well, today, with climate change and the north getting warmer, it's not hard to see that recreated mammoths would have an important role to play. But passenger pigeons? Giant flocks of them? Even more pigeons than we have now? Why would we want to bring them back? Ben Novak.
There's a certain argument that these giant flocks are exactly why we want them back. I mean, why bring back a passenger pigeon? Because it plays a particular role in its environment, a role that we feel is valuable. And this is forest disturbance. These giant flocks disturbed canopies and consumed a lot of nuts. They did a lot of things that would be equivocal to a hailstorm or a fire. And that sounds terrifying, I know, but there are a whole lot of species alive today, the animals like the New England cottontail or the American woodcock, that thrive on first-generation forests that pop up after these disturbances. And there are management plans trying to save these species from extinction or manage these species that involve having to recreate these forest disturbances. And if I had to choose between a forest fire or a hailstorm or some pigeons eating a whole bunch of nuts, I'm going to choose the pigeons.
Now, if every species has its own ecological role, how do you decide which ones to bring back and which ones to reject?
You know, I think the answers are going to vary so much from region to region and from species to species that probably a conclusive no or a conclusive yes is just that not actually in the cards. But some of the specific no's have to do with, for example, the extinct birds of Hawaii, the o'o and huila and other really adored birds that went extinct. If you brought them back now in the form they were when they died, they would die right out again because they are susceptible to avian flu. And the avian flu kills basically all of those old endemic birds up to the altitude of 4,000 feet. Which is most of the Hawaiian archipelago. So then you're faced either with, well, don't do it, it's a waste of money, or you've got a new ethical issue, which is, well, we're mucking around in the genes of these animals anyway. If we bring back the Hawaiian o'o and we can tweak it so that it's not susceptible to avian malaria, is that okay? Now, personally, I think it is okay, but I can see why lots of people would say, now you really are playing God or outreaching. You know, if it wasn't there in the original bird, you're not supposed to add it. Personally, I think by the time we get to that, and all of this stuff takes years, by the time we get to that, people would say either we figure out a way to eliminate avian malaria from the Hawaiian Islands, which was, after all, an invasive in its own right, or tweak the damn birds so that they can survive in this new environment.
That word, environment, is referring to a specific geographic space here, the Hawaiian Islands. But environment can mean so many other things too, both external and internal to an animal itself. And this raises a whole other set of practical problems and concerns. Beth Shapiro.
I think one of the most important things that people tend to forget in this genomic era is that for a long time, when we learn about genetics and biology, when we're in school, we're really pushed this idea of gene and environment interactions. And we seem to have forgotten that whole environmental interactions part of what we learned as biology students, because we're so focused now on the fact that we can sequence and assemble genomes from things that are extinct. We can't sequence and assemble that environment. There's a developmental environment. If something is developing within the uterus of another species, that's going to change the way that the genes are expressed in that developmental environment. And that we can't control because we can't bring an extinct animal back in the uterus of an extinct animal. There are also interactions between the microbiome and the diet and the environment that change gene expression. And then, of course, there are all the behavioral parts of what it is to be a particular species that are learned by interaction with a social group, with maybe a family group or with a larger social group like one might expect with mammoths. And this we also can't recreate. So a species is a very complicated thing.
There are many ideas about why we should and shouldn't bring extinct species back. And everyone involved to one degree or another has a list of pros and cons. Hendrik Poynar.
You know, on the pro side, I certainly see kids discussing de-extinction in the context of sort of conservation efforts, which is very interesting because certainly I, as growing up as a kid, it was all doom and gloom with my parents about conservation. I mean, it was, you know, we do our part. I grew up in Berkeley, you know, with tie-dyes and bell-bottoms, and, you know, conservation was a big, big issue in Berkeley at the time. But it was mostly about a negative image. It was about most of the species that I know won't be around, you know, when you or your kids are around anymore. And so maybe the de-extinction provides some hope. It brings light to a lot of species which are even unknown, brooding frog, and most people don't even know about the passenger pigeon, let alone the mammoth. Mammoth is lucky that way. It's sort of iconic, so it's in most people's minds.
And on the con side?
My nightmare scenario is that we bring back target species to be placed in zoos so people can huddle around and pay, you know, $50 to $1,000 to see one in some cage in every little zoo around the world. That, to me, is not at all what this movement should be about.
Do you feel that that's going to happen?
Well, it can happen. Yeah, it can happen. I don't think that the people that are at the grassroots and interested in it have that in mind, but I think it's also silly to think that it won't get out of their hands very quickly. I mean, all I have to do is control a patent. Scientists have seen that in the past, that they think they have control of a situation. It's really the people with the deep pockets that do. So it could very easily become a theme park thing, and that's not at all what this is about. It shouldn't be what it's about.
So, what about patents? Norman Carlin is an environmental lawyer with a PhD in biology and an interest in de-extinction and the law.
Well, the law does tend to focus very heavily on precedents and striving to do things that have been done before. And the approach that I've taken to the question of de-extinction really reflects that. That's not necessarily the way a scientist or a layperson might immediately think of it, but it is the way a lawyer would think of it. What is the closest thing that we already are very well familiar with and therefore can apply?
And the precedents here seem clear.
You can't patent a product of nature. You can't patent something that exists in nature.
But what about passenger pigeons or mammoths or bucardos? If de-extinction works and we can bring them back, they'll never be exactly as they were in nature.
Because any realistic prospect of recreating extinct species involves a fairly intense degree of genetic manipulation, you are dealing with something that is a product of human intervention, and therefore it should be probably patentable under existing laws and precedents.
In the United States, that is.
In the United States, it is possible to patent even a so-called higher organism. The classic example is the so-called oncomouse, which was a genetically modified mouse strain created to be susceptible to cancer for purposes of cancer research. And the oncomouse has been patented in the United States and in many other countries. In Canada, the Canadian Supreme Court has determined that, quote, higher life forms can't be patented. And so the oncomouse is not patented in Canada. And if someone were to, recreate a mammoth and set it loose in the Canadian Arctic, they could do so without concerns that that mammoth might have been patented in the United States, because it is simply not subject to patent law in the Canadian legal system.
When it happened briefly with the Bucardo, were there any legal takes on it?
Strangely, no. It might have to do with the fact that the Bucardo only lived for a few minutes after birth. I think the initial lack of success, because the researchers, had a fairly high bar to cross, kind of precluded them from having to think ahead, well, what happens after we've got a herd of these things in the captivity and we want to think about releasing them into the wild?
Should someone successfully recreate an extinct species, would you be willing to be on its legal team?
Absolutely. I think it would be a thrill.
And this brings us to the elephant in the room. How do you get de-extinct animals into the wild so they can run or stomp or fly where their ancestors once did? That's the dream, isn't it? Take passenger pigeons. Ben Novak.
The goal from the start is to give these birds a natural habitat as best as we can. But we don't just let the birds go into the wild. We introduce them into something called a soft release. So these would be large outdoor aviaries that encompass sections of natural forest in which the birds are exposed to the environment. And this exposes them to, diseases and bacteria and all sorts of natural elements such as rain and things. We don't want all of our birds to die, but we need to put them into this wild setting to know whether or not these birds have a chance to survive at all. And then after a certain time that those birds are breeding in that area, you begin to allow in some of these other animals that they once interacted with, chipmunks and squirrels, blue jays and other animals, and you start testing out and observing, is this new passenger pigeon an animal that's going to interact with its ecosystem in a healthy way? Is this still a good idea? And if it looks good, you take down the aviary walls and you say, okay, this first very promising generation of passenger pigeons that's been exposed to the wild and moved around, they seem to look like they know what they're doing. Let's, let them go and let them be free.
But even the best laid plans can run into problems. Dolly Jorgensen is an environmental historian at Umeå University in Sweden. She studies animal reintroductions, and there are lessons here that might be useful if de-extinct animals are ever reintroduced.
So a reintroduction is when you have an animal species that used to live in a particular area, and it no longer does so, but the species as a whole isn't extinct. And so what you do then is you take individuals from some other population that does still exist, and you move them to the place where they used to live.
Like beavers in Sweden. They were reintroduced several times, starting in 1922.
And over the next 20 years, about 80 beavers, about 40 pairs, were released in Sweden. And today, there are about 100,000 beavers in Sweden. They've been extremely prolific and successful in repopulating all of Sweden, and probably actually have a greater population and extent than they ever have, because there's no predators for them, because we're very good about getting rid of predators here. So that sounded like a great thing to do, and people still are happy about beavers. But there are local conflicts, because what happens when a beaver builds a dam that backs up the water onto your agricultural field, or that backs it up onto your road bridge? You need to remove it, because it's the infrastructure, the human infrastructure becomes damaged or threatened by those structures. So then you go about getting permits to remove the dam structure, and inevitably it means killing the beavers. Now there's so many beavers, we actually have hunting season from October to May, so over the winter, when you actually can kill beavers because there's so many. And that kind of conflict is a local conflict. You know, it's not a conflict that's happening at a whole species level. Nobody's out there saying, oh, let's get rid of beavers. But when it's on your property, you don't like beavers very much. And so when you look at that, you see that that's the kind of situation that we're in with animals in our daily lives. So while people talk about de-extincting and reintroducing a species, and they're talking about it at a really high level, at the local level, when that animal crosses boundaries, there become problems.
And if it's an extinct animal, like a mammoth or a bucardo or a passenger pigeon?
You know, nothing in ecology exists in isolation. It all exists in community. So there have to be all of the appropriate food sources and things that it uses, and all of the right insects and soil types. And it all has to be there in order for it to be successful. And there has to not be the pressure on it that killed it the first time. So if the pressure had been that an animal became extinct because it was hunted, then it would be really silly to reintroduce it and just have it get hunted again, unless you've changed the practice so that it wouldn't be hunted. And so then you have to figure out, well, why was it hunted? Was it hunted because it was economic value to do so? Then you need to make sure that it doesn't have that economic value. Was it hunted because people were afraid of it? Well, then somehow you need to convince people not to be afraid. Otherwise, they're just going to kill it again.
There are so many things about de-extinction you just can't predict. And the more you know, the more you realize what you don't know about the implications for all species, including us humans. Thomas Van Doren's been pondering this. He's an environmental philosopher at the University of New South Wales in Australia.
I think on the face of it, it's an exciting idea. But I think the further we delve down into it, into the practicalities, into the ethics, into a whole range of really complicated social issues, the more complicated it becomes. I guess I start from the perspective that we're having this conversation in the middle of an extinction crisis, in the middle of, according to many biologists, the sixth mass extinction event since complex life evolved on this planet. So not since the dinosaurs have we seen this kind of loss of biodiversity in a short period of time, and in this case, an incredibly short period of time.
According to many biologists, the sixth mass extinction has been going on in one phase or another for about 100,000 years, and it's all tied to human behavior. But the last 200 years, since the Industrial Revolution, are considered especially brutal, with pollution and habitat destruction, like deforestation. Today, anywhere from 2,000 to 100,000 species of plants and animals are said to be going extinct every year.
And I think that has to be in the foreground of all of our discussions about de-extinction, that this is an incredible period of loss that is going on largely unnoticed all around us. And so I think de-extinction poses immediately two questions to us. And the first one is really, shouldn't our primary focus be on preventing more species from going extinct? Shouldn't that be really our first and primary obligation to keep around all of those species that are still here? And then secondly, do we really want to desperately pull already extinct species back into this world? This is a world where, you know, we really haven't done a good job of making room for critically endangered species. Do we want to mass produce critically endangered species and with them the whole range of economic, cultural, ecological problems? And I think when we take both of those questions seriously, de-extinction emerges as something that will at best be a distraction from the kind of deep cultural work, deep cultural change that we need, and at worst will be a real threat to genuine efforts to address the current extinction crisis.
And according to Van Doren, a threat to our ability to mourn the species that are going extinct, as well as those that are gone.
That's one of the issues that I've been really interested in. And in particular, in the capacity of mourning to change the world. So there's a philosopher and grief counselor, Thomas Attig, who talks about mourning as a process of relearning the world. And so for him, what is relevant about mourning is that it's a confrontation with a changed world. It's through the process of mourning that we come to understand that the world has changed, that something about the world that we inhabited is gone, and that if we are going to go forward, that we must ourselves change. We have to relearn a changed world, and part of that relearning is reconsidering how we fit in and how we ourselves might have been changed and how changes might be demanded of us to go on. So in the absence of mourning, I think we miss those kinds of opportunities for deep reflective work as individuals and as a culture about how we might go on differently. So what I think we perhaps owe the dead is to genuinely learn from them and to change our ways to the extent that we don't send so many more species after them over the edge of extinction.
And this brings us to the end of the de-extinction story, at least for now. But the field is still evolving, and people are starting to think about taking the science we're learning here and applying it directly to animals on the brink of extinction, too. Like little brown bats, Tasmanian devils, and honeybees. If this works, we'd be giving critically endangered animals a genetic boost so they could adapt, evolve, and survive in their environments instead of going extinct. But who knows where that will lead them.
On Ideas, you've been listening to Undoing Forever. The program was prepared and presented by Britt Ray. The producer was Sarah Walsh. Music consultant Andy McNeil. Sound effects Greg DeClute. Technical production Dave Field. Business affairs Linda Monroe. And associate producer Liz Nagy. Special thanks to the Macaulay Library at Cornell University for field recordings of extinct and endangered animals. To find out about upcoming Ideas programs and podcasts, sign up for our weekly online newsletter. Just go to our website at cbc.ca/ideas and be sure to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. The executive producer of Ideas is Greg Kelly, and I'm Paul Kennedy.